This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome to the Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris and Julian Ng.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's the 29th of June, just the end of the, coming up to the end of the month now.
Oh my goodness, yes. And starting the second half of the year.
Absolutely. Right. We've been thinking about it, talking about it for months, but now it's here.
Oh my goodness. this is completely slipped.
You're in such a state of shock, Melissa.
Yeah. Well, it's also payday, so that gets other people excited.
Oh,
they
yes.
might not
okay.
be so excited about the passing of time, but they often are excited by the fact that come at the end of the month, they get their paycheck. And so if you're not living from paycheck to paycheck, maybe it's not so exciting for you. But for those who are living from paycheck to paycheck, this must be very exciting.
This will be exciting. Most people to live from paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah. And then what you do is, as soon as the money comes in, a lot of it's going out to pay rent.
Well,
pay
it's also Raya.
It is, in fact. And it's, the week before Raya. And of course, there's a lot of speculation in the air, as it were, about whether Friday next week will be a holiday, declare a public holiday. I know there was a report in the Star that suggested that maybe, that public civil servants would get the day off. But what about the rest of us?
When I heard someone mentioned this to me in passing, and when I heard, I got overly excited in front of the boss.
I think it'd be
a prospect of Friday being a public holiday.
It'd be more productive and better cost saving for the nation to have Friday off.
Why? Why is it?
Because people will go to work
productive.
And people will go to work and not
and
do
slack off.
Not do anything.
Oh. Yeah,
right. It'll be an effective holiday.
Yeah, or at least it would be, yeah. So the question is, what would make the private sector in this case, fall in step with the public sector if government in fact declares Friday a holiday?
So do you remember the times when the government did declare a public holiday for a special occasion? I think it was winning something. I can't
badminton.
Remember.
Badminton.
Was it badminton or was it football? I can't
remember.
I don't
know. It was promised. I think we didn't win it, so we didn't get it.
If the government declares that, does that mean it's only for the public sector, or does the private sector also follow suit?
I think the whole nation.
The whole nation.
Because the whole nation wants to celebrate in any championship that we win, right?
Yes, but the third day of Raya is not a championship, and there's no competition. As far as I know.
It's a Lemang championship. Okay,
you never know.
I'm not religious, and I don't know about that. But anyway, we have an exciting lineup for you this morning. For those of you who like the dulcet tones of Michael Yoshikami, he's coming on this morning, isn't he? And after that, at 8 o'clock, after the 8 o'clock news, we have Ashran Ghazi. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Ashran Ghazi.
And he's the CEO of the Malaysian Global Innovation and Creative Centre, or MAGIC.
Yeah. I think we know this agency better as MAGIC. If you asked me, stopped me on the road, I couldn't spell out the full what it stood for. But of course, it was designed to become a one-stop center for entrepreneurs. But MAGIC has had a bit of a start-stop history. If you remember, the very famous CEO Cheryl Yeo was
Cheryl Goh.
Cheryl
yeah.
Goh. Was it Cheryl Yeo? Cheryl Yeo, the former CEO of MAGIC. She abruptly left in December. She was quite high profile because, she was from Silicon Valley, she had a lot of startups under her belt, and then she was kind of lured back home to start this MAGIC center. And she left, and there was a lot of speculation as to why she left so abruptly before her contract ended.
Personal reasons?
I think politics made its way into
a lot of speculation.
No one has gotten an interview with her. Did she say why she was leaving?
If she did come out and say why she was leaving, it would open up MAGIC to a lot of criticism, because if those allegations were true, they were all actually about politics. For example, some of the politicians say that she didn't focus enough on the Bumiputra sector. So if she really admitted to that, then the whole survival of MAGIC would be in question.
Yeah, I don't know about politics so much, but there were rumors that she faced certain pressures about not helping the Bumiputra entrepreneurs, about not focusing so much on non-tech sectors. So there was a lot of rumors circulating. She didn't deny or confirm them. She said she wanted to go and take some time off. And she's left Magic now. So there's a new CEO, Ashraf Ghazi. He's just been appointed in May. And I think it's interesting to know where he plans to take Magic forward. I mean, I would like to ask him, quite frankly, I mean, were the rumors in fact true? Will he face the same pressures? Is he going to steer Magic in a different direction?
Yeah, well, that's exciting, because if we can at least nail it from his side in terms of having some certainty as to what was going wrong, that might have contributed to her departure. Mm. Then we'll get a sense of how this institution works. So,
and also, I think to address what's going right, a lot of countries are jumping onto this bandwagon of creating some kind of technological, biotechnological hub ecosystem. Everyone is getting in on a game. So Malaysia really also needs to up its game.
You know, Magic comes. Magic is essentially under the Ministry of Finance. So essentially, it's funded by Malaysian taxpayers. Under budget 2016, it was given 35 million ringgit. So, you know, as taxpayers, what do you think the ROI should be on that 35 million? Do you want to see something come out of Magic?
Well, I think the ROIs also are a case of what the definition is, right? You can have straight-off returns on your capital or your investments, but they also have a kind of multiplier effect. So people hope that when governments go into business, governments actually create jobs that are beyond that that establishment that they set up, you know, the ecosystem, the knock-on effects. The reason why you created Proton was so that you have this vendor system that generates employment and generate a whole support system for Malaysia's industrial base. So will this happen to Magic? Or hopefully Magic doesn't go the way of Proton.
Right? Yeah. Well, you know, on ROI, I mean, I think what we want often is government to play the role of enabler. I mean, I don't think you necessarily want government and government agencies to be making money, certainly not that kind of return. But coming back to the ecosystem issue, I think it's very interesting when you see countries trying to replicate the success of the creative industries as it's located in different parts of the world. You have, of course, that very famous thesis by Richard Florida about the rise of the creative class, right? And so much of the ecosystem is about talent. You know, and attracting talent. So first of all, not to think only in nationalistic terms, but think of talent that's coming from around the world. If you see now, you know, Berlin is vying for all the talent that's in Britain, you know, yeah, that might be displaced. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and saying, well, come to Berlin. So there is a premium place on talent, and talent can move globally. It's very mobile. Singapore, you know, kind of reverse the Richard Florida thesis by trying to say, well, what was it that was in, you know, if you know Richard Florida, right? And his thesis was that tolerance and acceptance of diversity was one of the markers of these spaces where creative industries flourished. And so what they wanted to do was to show to the world that they were a tolerant society, they were embracing difference. And one of the key strategic moves they made was, in fact, changing, very publicly, changing their policy on the LGBT community, because the visibility of the LGBT community was one marker of tolerance and acceptance of diversity. So a fascinating thesis, and in a country like Singapore, used to drive public policy. The question, of course, whether Malaysia could ever be in a situation like that, where it would, you know, be embracing that kind of diversity in terms of people. We have so many difficulties, yeah, on that score.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm going to go look this up. David Florida?
No, Richard Florida.
Richard Florida.
Yeah, and the book is The Rise of the Creative Class. I mean, he really, and this is old stuff. I mean, you know, this is coming on almost, I think, two decades now. And so, you know, countries like Singapore, you know, really off the, you know, taking off many decades ago, thinking about these issues, you know, if we start to think about these issues now, we would be really late in the, yeah, game, as it were. But anyway, better late than never is the cliche, isn't it?
Well, there's a quick check on Twitter shows that Darth Vadai has said that some private companies are making staff take forced leave on Friday. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing
that happens if the government doesn't give a public holiday to everybody.
Does that mean your annual leave gets deducted?
I think it's not fair to the employees. Employees' labor rights, you know, labor rights.
Okay, I just want to check myself on the age of that book, The Rise of the Creative Class by Richard Florida. That's 2002, so it's a decade and a half.
Not quite.
Well, it's not as old as I thought it was.
It's an eternity in the tech world.
Ah, that may be, and for some human beings as well.
But you know, the principles are timeless, right?
I think when it comes to questions of diversity, I mean, if you're going to attract talent, you don't want to be a place that says, well, we only want certain types of people.
I think we have to reduce our xenophobia, especially with the expat community, the immigration policies that we have. And the degree of freedoms and dissent we are allowed to make that are so essential to innovation, I think.
Absolutely. Creative thinking, dissenting thinking, all these things are in the mix. But tell us, Julian, before we forget, what's on the S&M show today?
Well, we're just coming from the aftermath of the Brexit. And today we're questioning whether government-linked companies and government-linked investment companies, respectively called GLCs and GLICs in Malaysia, whether they are stabilizing factors in crisis situations. And also, our markets are very dominated by government agencies. Is that a good thing or good thing over the long term?
Yeah, well, okay, I look forward to that discussion. Now, maybe time to quick catch up on what's happening in the news overnight. A suicide and gun attack at Istanbul's Atatürk International Airport has killed 28 people and injured over 60. This is quite a stunning attack. Carnage, I think, is the word that's being used in the media. Recent bombings in Turkey have been linked to either Kurdish separatists or the Islamic State group. So
this happened overnight, right? So I got an alert this morning to say that this had happened. And I think for me, the frequency of the attacks in Istanbul, which used to be, I mean, it's the bridge between the East and the West, right? So it's the middle bit of that. And it's always been, for me, a very moderate Muslim society. And used to be the model of moderate Muslim societies. We used to model ourselves after Turkey.
Yeah, but so where is this tension coming from? If it's the Kurdish separatists, it's got to do with the long-standing repression of the Kurdish minority.
Has it been said that it's part of the Kurdish separatists?
We've had attacks where the Kurds, whatever parties or splinter groups have admitted or claimed that some of the attacks. We had that rather famous one with, I think, involving two women militants. Also, because Turkey is on the border with the war against ISIL, and so they have suffered. And remember, I think it was about a year ago now, a leftist political group was having a youth meeting or something, and they had this terrible bombing. It took out dozens of young activists. So, the country might be moderate, and this is a lesson for us, right? The country might be moderate, but depending on how you play your politics, things can go quite, pear-shaped. Now, following up on that, because it's our own local bombing two nights ago, at a pub, a grenade attack, and police have initially came out and said it was not a terrorist attack. But now there's been some sort of claim made on Facebook, and they're going to be investigating that claim. If you read it, the person suggested that they were being motivated by these kind of militant ideologies. Now, also Singapore, very quickly, is it nationalist sentiment, a normal grouse about people in your neighborhood, or is it hate speech? A court in Singapore has sentenced the editor of the website The Real Singaporean to 8 months in jail for publishing anti-foreigner material on his website.
So this was he was charged under the Sedition Act in Singapore. I was trying to look at what it was that he had said. Apparently, he had said something that constituted as hate speech to Filipino and mainland Chinese, if I'm not mistaken. Again, this comes back to your point, Julian, about how you said, you know, we really need to check this xenophobia that's rising in every country. You know, I mean, not just in countries that are afflicted with the migrant crisis, not just in Europe with in Britain with the Brexit, but here back home, it's rising.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that this doesn't constitute a free speech or dissent that is needed in innovation. This is just racism, I guess.
Yeah, but you know, I think the, what the thing the real Singaporean tries to capture are concerns in the local population about things like Singapore's talent policies. We talked about the Richard Florida thesis just now. Singapore, of course, has opened up its doors to a whole range of foreign talent, including expatriates, you know, working in certain sectors. Singaporeans feeling the pressure. This has had actually implications for the popularity of the PAP. And there was, in fact, a protest, I think some 2 years now, where Singaporeans came saying, well, we don't want to have more people. They're already feeling so much pressure in the city because there was a white paper on population increase. Singapore, the PAP government trying to push for larger numbers of people. We're going to come back after this and maybe also look at the story of the Penang Mufti. That's kind of galloping away, and that's coming up shortly. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and you just heard Boys Don't Cry by The Cure. I'm Sharad. You're also here, Melissa and Julian, with me this morning. It's now 20 minutes past 6, and the 29th of June, we say, you know, a day for your paycheck. Maybe you've already got it, especially because next week's Raya, and you probably already started your Raya shopping. Well, Julian, you were talking about xenophobia and the need to kind of really address that question, you know, hating or fear of foreigners. But what about loving foreigners? Apparently, there's a major phenomenon in Malaysia, loving foreigners. And there's a MMO, a Malay Male Online Project article, very interesting because it addresses this in picking up a study by University Putra Malaysia about this love of foreigners. Apparently, and I'm going to read the Malay because it's just beautiful, the Malay. Wanita tempatan cahaya dengan mata, sorry, wanita tempatan cahaya dengan ayat manis warga Bangladesh dan Indonesia. So, wow. Which means Malaysian women, melt, you know, with the sweet words of Bangladeshis and Indonesians. And so, but I think this is a really complicated story. I looked at this article. It didn't give enough material, especially around the methodology. And a lot of it seemed to be very commonplace things that we'd expect. You know, locals feel that foreigners, and this could be boys and girls, I mean, local boys and all local girls, feel that foreigners treat them in a kind of like, you know, special way.
So can I just ask whether this study just focused on women falling for Bangladeshi and Indonesian men, or do they also look at other expat communities, women who fall for British men or French men or Italian men or you know, Malaysian men who fall for British women or American women?
No, I don't know. There's not enough material in the report, but clearly there's a lot of love going on. I mean, there's some hate.
That's good.
You know, and I think actually on display recently is, you know, hate in Britain. Just those, I think you've seen on Twitter, perhaps on social media, you know, videos circulating about, especially, you know, pimply-faced British people, you know, sort of attacking people they consider foreign in that country, following because the leave a vote. But
I think the immigration complaint was very well featured in the vote for Brexit and the campaigning. But, you know, I was working in Hong Kong a few years ago, and apparently in Hong Kong, there are not enough men to marry off with the women. And this forced the women over there in Hong Kong to actually go out and look for expatriate men. And this was a big thing a few years ago, and it came up in newspaper articles. So, you know, the lack of male suitors forced females or women over there in Hong Kong to love foreigners.
Yeah, I think loving foreigners is a great thing. And I think anything that adds to the
gene
pool. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we, you know, on the peninsula of Malaysia has been the recipient of 1,000 years of trade flows. You know, people are...
I'm with you, Sharad. I would say that I would rather we love foreigners than we hate them.
And look at you. I mean, you know, your mixed heritage. Oh, me. I mean, Penang is just a melting pot of people. It's just an extraordinary place because you can think of, you know, at least 200 years of miscegenation of people constantly, you know, loving each other and fluid exchange over two centuries.
How do you translate that to a kind of national policy? Because we know that we are kind of xenophobic in our policies, but at the same time, we also want to protect not only us, but other countries like the UK. The Brexit vote being the prime example, they want to block out immigrations coming into the country and changing the makeup of their countries, right? How should that kind of love be translated in policy?
Okay, well, this is a difficult one because the question is, I think the promise of the Leave campaign was it would be able to define who gets to come in, right? So it's not saying we don't want any foreigners coming in, but we get to choose the foreigners who come in. And that's something that Singapore has been very clear about. It is, you know, strategizing the kind of talent. Some of it they call expatriate, which has to do with the creative class. And then some of it is actually working class when it comes to, you know, supplying labor for certain industries, whether it's service industry or, in fact, in construction and such. So there's these mix, right? The idea is to have the policy tools should be as complex and nimble as possible in dealing with this whole thing. We never think of Bangladeshis as potentially coming in with either students, although they are students, or coming in as,
creative class.
Part of the creative class. I mean, all that talent in Nepal. Nepal has, you know, developed some aspects of the kind of digital economy as well. Clouds, the cloud technology, a lot of it's situated in Nepal. So, I mean, why not? I mean, why not have that kind of complexity when it comes to thinking of foreign policy?
Actually, if you think 20, 30 years down the road from today, the next generation, the ethnic makeup in Malaysia would be so different, don't you think?
Yeah.
And what kind of implications will this have for policy?
I think the problem is that a part of us wants things to stabilize. We think things are good now, but, you know, and things change. I mean, Lee Kuan Yew very famously said at some point he needed to maintain ethnic ratios. I mean, remember we talked about this when Abdul Ahmad passed away, that, you know, Abdul Ahmad had put out this thesis about the social contract. Lee Kuan Yew has said, you know, that there were ethnic ratios that he wanted to maintain, right? And he wanted to maintain the dominance of the Chinese community because he felt that, and he has his own kind of racial viewpoint, and, you know, driven by some genetic theory. And so, you know, is that adequate? Is that, in fact, got scientific foundations? I don't know.
Can we look at Australia as the giant melting pot of generations of intermarriages and many different races?
I think Australia is an example for this part of the world. But, you know, the biggest melting pot and the biggest immigrant country is America. Right?
Yeah, but there's already a discourse, and we're going to be picking that up later on when we on Current Affairs, when we look at the Australian polls, is that there's this whole discourse called Australians last, and they feel a lot of white Australians feel that they are being discriminated against, and so that's also being played out in the Australian general elections that's coming up. Now, following up very quickly on all these other stories that are in the news, because the Pahang Mufti, his labeling of fellow Malaysians as Kafe Harbi, a designation that makes them legitimate targets for murder or killing. Now, that's caused a whole kind of controversy. PKR linked popular preacher Wan Gee lodged a report 2 days ago against the Pahang Mufti. And now constitutional law expert Dr. Abdul Aziz Bari, also a DAP member, he's called on the Pahang Sultan and the Conference of Rulers to weigh in on this because he says the Pahang Mufti is directly under the authority of the Sultan, and therefore the Sultan cannot be silent on this issue.
You know, Sharad, you've said before on the show that you think the Sedition Act is an archaic act. It should be thrown out and not used in any respect. So in this case, the fact that, you know, I mean, the Pahang Mufti is not being charged under the Sedition Act, is that a good thing that this act is not being invoked at the moment?
Well, no, I think they're two separate issues, right? You don't want to use the Sedition Act in any instance, and I think you don't need to.
Yeah.
But if you use it selectively, then you have a problem. The other issue, of course, is how do you deal with speech like this? Because in some countries, this might constitute hate speech. Well, we need the courts to adjudicate this issue. Is this a form of hate speech? Does a speech like this open up the possibilities of dehumanizing, you know, fellow citizens or other individuals living in the country, and open them up to violence, right?
Yeah, so that was under what was the agreement, the definition of hate speech?
I think the Johannesburg principles.
Yeah. In fact, I think that it is because of the Sedition Act that gives a certain class of people the right to say stupid things, right? If you took away the power of the Sedition Act, then everybody would be equal in assessing what's being said publicly, and the public will not be so sensitive about such things. We need to have these very dissenting public discourses so that whenever utterances like this are made, it just be treated as just something else.
Yeah, right? Except this is a man who has religious authority, and that
I
is
think we need education, not the Sedition Act.
Absolutely.
Well said, Julian.
Okay, a very quickly, Azmin Ali, there's been a poll on him. He, of course, is a Selangor Menteri Besar. He's got an approval rating of some 65%, according to Merdeka Center, an independent pollster. Also, that survey was disaggregated in terms of ethnic group and age, and we should actually delve deeply into this. We don't have time this morning. Maybe we'll pick it up later about 7:15 when we look at the news.
Maybe we can pick it up with Azmin Ali on the Breakfast Grill. It's an open invitation still.
Yep. We've run out of time again. We're coming up with the first bulletin of the day with Audrey Raj, BFM 89.9. You're listening to Hang On To Yourself by David Bowie and To The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin with Julian Ng and Melissa Idris. And we've been talking about all kinds of things, loving foreigners, hating foreigners. In fact, what happens when Malaysians become foreigners? Well, sometimes they excel. We have two examples in the news today, over the last couple of days, really. Yuna, who's, of course, a Malaysian singer based in the US, she's been, and her album has been cited by the Rolling Stones magazine. It's one of the top R&B albums released this year. Her album is called Chapters, I believe. So there, Yuna doing Malaysians proud by doing well in the music scene in the US. Also another Malaysian, but this is a very difficult and tricky question story because he left Malaysia citing discrimination back home. So he left Malaysia for the US and now found himself, he's now sort of staying in the US. His name is Julian Sanjeevan. And he cited discrimination about his sexuality. So he's a gay man. And some will find this a point of pride. Some of us will be struck by horror. But at any rate, whatever your position, he's gone on to become the director of one of the largest gay pride parades ever in New York. And this will happen this year. He was elected as March director by the Heritage of Pride Committee.
I like that they have that title, March Director. Yeah. We need a March Director for BFM.
Yeah. But then we'd have to go marching somewhere.
Yeah, we could have to march about something. Yeah,
maybe
holiday on Friday would
you
be the first
thing. You
want to carry the flag? I want to carry the baton.
Oh, you want a twirling baton? Yeah. Oh, okay, you can see where all this is going very quickly, a quick descent.
But Sharad, you know, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago about not claiming Malaysians who've left our shores as our own. So what, I mean, you know, especially those who go
to Syria and Iraq and bomb people and kill Yazidis.
Well,
yeah.
Well, let's say those who have gone on to achieve something overseas, and then perhaps they were born here in Malaysia, but then they've gone on. Well,
I think there are many out there. Yeah. The list is long.
So can we claim them as ours, as Malaysians?
Well, yes, we can.
I think especially with Yuna, I think she had a start here, and I think perhaps you know, she's apparently from Subang, says Tim, who's paneling. he's like doing something. He's doing something with his fist and
it's
his
like
chest.
Subang proud.
Is it really? I thought he was having a heart attack.
You know, my grill guest from a few days ago, Anthony Lee. He, the boss of AIG and PIAM in Malaysia. He is a Talent Corp subject. He is a Talent Corp returnee. They went in to entreat him to come back to Malaysia, and here he is. He
had an earlier career in the Game of Thrones series, wasn't he? Didn't he play Littlefinger? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't want to get into this conversation, not least because it has spoiler elements in it.
Okay. So, but yeah, I mean, talking about education, there is just a recent survey that found that a lot of parents are willing to take on serious amounts of debt in order to fund their kids' education. Now, the question is this a good thing? Yeah, and I think it was a subject of a show that you did, Julian, sometime ago.
Which happens to be Melissa's favorite Ring It and Sense episode.
It is the best Ring It and Sense show ever.
Can we tweet this out, the link to that show? Because I think people who missed it might want to catch it this time around.
So the show is about a trade-off between children's education and your retirement, because the decision to send your child to a private school or to send them overseas will have an impact on not just on you, but on your family's finances. So it needs to be a well thought out decision. And I just found that interview completely enlightening. And you know what? I'm going to play a clip from that interview. So Julian, you spoke to Yap Ming Hui, independent financial advisor from Whitman. And this is his advice to parents.
You see, you've got this couple, they got two children. Okay, this couple is in their 30s and they have got annual income of 440,000 and their net worth is 5 million. So as you can tell, they are financially very strong. So if they do not send the children overseas, they do not send the children to international school, they just put them through government school and local university, then the money that they have will last them up to the age of 95 years old. So which means that they can enjoy very good retirement, plus the children going local quality education. But if they decide to send one child to go to private school and to send one child to go overseas, then their wealth will last much more earlier at the age of 77. And if they send both for this kind of education, their wealth will last at the age of 59. So that just goes to show how impactful is the cost of education.
You know, after I heard that interview, I called my mom to thank her for sending me to a good school and to, you know, to get to further my education.
Yeah.
Because it was so arresting to hear how much parents have to give up for kids.
I mean, it's really a symptom of failed policy, isn't it? Because when parents have to put all of their life savings just to educate their children, there is a sense of unfairness in it. But, you know, I'm quite optimistic about the future, because I think that really, is it going forward, is it a matter of education for education's sake, or are we getting a tertiary degree, that certificate, that piece of paper for survival? And can we survive without a certification?
Well, you know, I think there are two things that immediately struck me, that this is the Malaysian story. The story, and this is, you know, a story that's repeated generation after generation of parents who sacrifice, make sacrifices, especially on the field of, in the field of education. If you think of your parents and who put out the money, maybe it was the state, but or often it was, in fact, you know, some school teacher that squirrel away money, send their kids off to England. I mean, that's always the big story, right? Middle class Malaysia.
Yeah, but you know, but Shira, before it was like a passport. If you had a degree, then your future would be secure. But today, degree holders are a dime a dozen, and the economic situation is kind of closing in on us. Yeah. So it's a case of supply being more than demand, right?
So
for graduates.
There was also another part of that interview which also struck me, because you asked, should then parents think that, if I give my kids good education now, later when they are successful in life, they'll take care of me, maybe give me a monthly stipend. Yeah. And the financial planner, Ming Hui, said that no, that should not be the case, because God knows what happens in the future, right?
That's
the
right.
Cost of living could escalate. Your kids may not
have enough
money
income
for themselves.
You know, this question of the quality of education and the value of the university degree, I think is a huge one, because you're absolutely right. People are getting into massive debt over something that might not be paying off as much. And having worked in the education sector myself and, you know, in these private tertiary institutions, I too am very doubtful about the quality of so much private higher education in this country. There are all kinds of little schemes, faster, quicker, better, you know, skip A-levels, do a diploma foundation course that will get you, you know, a discount right on years of learning. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I have another angle to this story. What if parents, I mean, 60% of the people who took the survey found that they're willing to go into debt to further their education, right? So if parents are making that sacrifice, does that mean parents hold all the power to decide what you study? So they've taken a loan. You do the medical degree that I want you to do.
Yeah, but it's not just about money. It's a thing called the magic of being a parent. An Asian parent.
It's got power.
They have power.
Look,
it's
parental power. You know, the governments are so bad at being in business, right? Anything that they touch would is a sure way of making losses. What makes us think that as parents we have some kind of insight into the future as to what would be demanded and what not? I mean, today we have a surplus of medical graduates, of lawyers, of accountants, and in many the experience of many countries, you know, they're quite close to home, Philippines, India, for example, graduates driving taxis. We see our Uber drivers today, some of them without jobs, but with a very good educational background, they are driving their Uber or Grabs. Not that it's a bad thing, but you cannot predict what is going to be in demand.
Absolutely. I think there's an issue of the market, but I also think that there's an issue about quality education. So people have those degrees and certificates, which have become, of course, part of the culture of contemporary Malaysia, and it's actually quite global. But the question is, what is it actually doing for you? What kind of skills? I mean, what kind of communicative skills? What kind of analytical skills do people actually pick up in these courses? And I am very doubtful that there is serious quality on those two scores.
But I'm a little bit more optimistic than you, Sharad, because I think that the future holds promise. You can now go online and get education in any subject that you want. It's available out there. And I guess this anti-establishment fervor that's going on right now gives people the kind of spirit and courage and determination to go out there and do their own business. The internet is making it easier for people to do business for their financial survival. And we'll come to a point in time where you again come down to separate the need to be educated and the need to financially survive. You know, we're coming to that era.
I think the difference between being educated and getting a certificate, it's real. It's a genuine distinction that needs to be made, mm-hmm. right? But I disagree with a lot of people who advocate, you know, sort of, you can do it on yourself, by yourself, you can go to YouTube, educate. There's a term, autodidact, and that really means you teach yourself. But, and history has shown that they have these autodidacts. People like Pramodya Anantatur was said to be an autodidact. But I actually believe in the role of teachers. I believe that no real serious education can happen without the mediating presence of good teachers.
But Jules, you're referring to MOOCs, right? Those massive online courses where there is a mediator, there is a teacher to impart the knowledge, but it's just done
from the top universities in the world. Stanford, you're talking about Stanford, Yale,
just done
Harvard.
Online.
But they don't give you the same sort of interaction.
They don't sit next to you and teach you, but it's there for you. And I think that offers some kind of hope.
Absolutely. I mean, there's amazing democratization of education on one hand and possibilities for exposure. At the same time, I really think that education happens in classrooms, that happens with a mature mind teaching younger minds. There's a modeling that happens when you become educated. You see the way arguments are
agreed,
made. You
but,
hear
you know,
things.
This is a catch-22, though, because it's either you choose a potential bankruptcy or you choose education for your children, right? But what is the middle ground? The middle ground is some kind of basic education plus survival without getting into
Well, I think one of the things that really undervalued in Malaysia is vocational education. People should stop doing degrees. I mean, I think degrees are really just for a minority, and everybody else should get a real skill.
But it's a collective mindset. How do you change a collective mindset to say that you don't need to have that degree, that master's degree, that PhD most of the jobs that we have today?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, why aren't we putting more money and heft behind vocational institutions that teach people real skills, you know, along with which you can teach people communicative and analytical skills, right? It doesn't mean that if you're a carpenter, you don't have to have those skills as well. Vocational training is not about saying that you're one rung lower. And I think that's what vocational education has become in this country.
Agreed. And I think that the internet and the concept of online businesses will equalize that status between a carpenter and, say, a banker or a lawyer.
Well, maybe not bankers, but definitely a lawyer.
I think so. I think bankers are increasingly demonized now.
Okay, we're going to hammer in the morning. We're going to hammer in the noontime. But that's not the song that's coming up. In fact, we have Moondance by Van Morrison, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.